Well, welcome to this third seminar on approaches to religion. And today we're looking at religion and politics. I've got a handout which I'm going to kind of work through. And then we can just talk about any issues or problems as they arise. So I'm going to read some of it out because I've sort of prepared it. So there's two handouts. Oh, hello. Is that the number I predicted?
Yes, it is.
I predicted six people. That's six people.
There's one more.
Ah, okay. So
I don't know.
So, well, religion has always been deeply implicated with politics and lies behind many political ideals. Oh, no, good one. In his inaugural address, I'm on my first point here. Barack Obama underlined this connection when he proclaimed, this is a quote from his inaugural address, "The time has come to reaffirm our enduring spirit, to choose our better history, to carry forward that precious gift, that noble idea passed on from generation to generation, the God-given promise that all are equal, all are free, all deserve a chance to pursue their full measure of happiness." Deserve to own private property and so on. So the American ideals of equality and freedom are deeply rooted in the Christian ethic and textual tradition, and the formation of religions as institutions has always been closely implicated in the formation of states and the legitimizing of particular social and political structures. Many contemporary thinkers have claimed that religion can be understood in terms of power relationships, and that the discourse of religion hides a generally oppressive will to power. By contrast, many religious communities claim that religion is the wellspring of their life's energy, and that tradition cannot be explained only in terms of politics and the will to power. While the secularization paradigm continues to develop in some Western countries where the churches continue to empty, elsewhere in the world there's a resurgence of religion, and religions now play an important part in global politics, and the secular liberal idea that religions are dying out is simply wrong in the global context. As a senior figure in the World Bank said in 2009, the vast reach of religions and interfaith networks, interfaith work of organisations such as the World Faith Development Dialogue, that's the thing that she founded, and the Tony Blair Faith Foundation, are important for social cohesion and intercommunal relationships. So it's like the World Bank's recognising the importance of religion for these networks of communication. Now, the place of religion in the politics in the public sphere should not be assessed purely negatively in the wake of the terrible events of 9/11, where religion and politics were intertwined in a devastating way, but it also needs to be assessed in terms of a realistic contribution that religions can make to reconciliation in the future world. Now, the main question we'll raise today, that we'll discuss today, is can religious orientation be tradition-specific yet function in a pluralist democratic context? Now, the problem comes when political representation of the self conflict in the public arena, as we have seen with the issue of girls wearing the hijab in secular schools in France and the banning of the burqa in France in about 3 months ago, wasn't it? Now, the place of religion is contentious. Some argue for an extreme secularism, that there should be no place for religious voices in the public sphere, in serious public debate, that informs legislature, while others argue for the importance of religion in public debate and the need for religious perspectives on legal and moral issues facing a society. So, religion in the public sphere. I've whisked through this, I'm now on my... the bottom of the first page. Now, as the world population approaches around 7 billion in 2010, and the world faces attendant problems of resource management and distribution, the question of ideology and the place of belief systems in public discourse becomes highly relevant. For the human future, these environmental and economic problems, which are also political problems, will have to be solved, and to do that, issues of identity, conflict resolution, and what people understand to be the purpose and meaning of their life have to be addressed. Shared solutions to shared problems entail mutual understanding and the ability to negotiate conflict and disagreement. And if religions are central to human subjectivity, to the meaning of our lives and the stories we tell about ourselves, then religions will need to have a stronger voice in the public sphere through reasoned debate, even though some contemporary religious expressions would see the destruction of that very sphere. So, some Islamicist and some Christian fundamentalist groups, for example. But we first need a brief reminder of the history of the problem. Sitting in his rooms in Christchurch College, not far from here, in this very room, John Locke, who dies in 1704, was weary of the English Civil War that had ended not too long earlier, and the 30 Years' War that had torn Europe apart shortly before, and had finally mostly ended with the Peace of Westphalia in 1648. Now, he saw that an end to such conflict lay in the idea of toleration, the toleration of religions by the state, which could be fostered by a strict division, between state and church. The corollary to this would be that religion would be relegated to the private realm, leaving the public sphere for governance. The state should ensure the commonwealth or, quote, society of men for the pursuit of life, liberty, health, and private property. Sounds like the Conservative Party, doesn't it? But should not interfere with matters of religious conscience. For the interests of the state, it matters not to which religion one belongs, as the role of the citizen is to obey the legislature and carry out his or her obligations and self-interested actions within the framework of law. If, however, a religion interferes with the state, then we reach the limits of tolerance, and religious dissent, which becomes political, cannot be tolerated by Locke. So he wants to completely depoliticise religion, with the exception of the Church of England. Locke laid the foundations for a theory of the state in the following centuries and the development of the secular age. It was not that Locke dismissed the relevance of religion. He was not a French encyclopedist of 150 years later, the following century, but he wanted to restrict its power to matters of conscience and morality established through reason that supported God's revelation. Now, the roots of the public-private distinction with regard to religion go back before Locke to the medieval period, with the idea of the seculum, or century, or age, which is first used in opposition to religion, where religion designates being within a monastic order. Thus, people in the seculum are living a regular life in ordinary time, as opposed to those outside the seculum in the monastery living a religious life in higher time, closer to eternity. Locke, implicitly drawing on this distinction, advocated the depoliticisation of religion in the sense that the non-political institution should have no quarrel with the state, and the state should have no problem with the private practices and beliefs of its citizens. Along with other deists, Locke was responsible for the emphasis on reason and the idea of rational religion, a religion of ethics arrived at through thoughtful effort. As we've seen, this development led to the Enlightenment and contributed to scientific critique of religion. But what are the political implications of this development, and how does it affect us today? Now, Locke is one of the founders of the modern discourse about society and the idea of the social contract that Hume was disparaging of. Now, the public sphere is a shared arena where subjectivities can be displayed and where the institutions that an individual invests in can find articulation. The control of the public sphere means power for the one who controls it. And we have seen examples of this in recent history. The church, in its battle with Galileo, for example, was not only fighting over contested notions of truth, but also over power, over who controlled the public sphere of discourse, over whose truth wins out in the end. So like Copernicus, they weren't worried about Copernicus because he's just writing books, but Galileo, what did he do? He invented a telescope, and with a telescope you can see your enemies coming. So through the invention of the telescope, Galileo immediately brings his thinking to the attention of the authorities, because his ideas find material expression and articulation. In our own day, religious groups vie for media attention in highly voluble public debate, and highly voluble public debate can be heard throughout the world over political and moral matters, from stem cell research to abortion. The debate about the links between religion and terrorism, to whether one can wear a cross or a hijab in a French school, and so on. The public realm is occupied by contesting voices, which is as it should be, but problems come when contestation has to result in decision and finally legislation, which is linked to the idea of who defines the public sphere. Religion is a hot topic in this area, particularly in Europe. While there was a public debate in all civilizations prior to the rise of the West, the very idea of the public sphere as we understand it today has developed in Western democracies since the 17th and 18th centuries. John Locke was an important voice, but also Kant's understanding of enlightenment as autonomy rather than heteronomy. And Charles Taylor defines the public sphere in a useful way. This is a common space in which, this is on page 2, in which the members of society are deemed to meet through a variety of media, print, electronic, and also face-to-face encounters, to discuss matters of common interest and thus to be able to form a common mind about these. We might complement this with Habermas's contention that the public sphere is, quote, a space of reasoned communicative exchange. Salvatore claims that the public realm constitutes a third sphere along with economics and political system. The public sphere is thus closely associated with the media and forms of communication that occurred in the post-1945 period, although its formation can be found, according to Habermas, in the coffee houses and salons of Europe and the rise of the bourgeois class. Indeed, it is essential to modern global society where communication across thousands of miles is instant. But the public sphere is not simply a neutral forum for conveying information. It is rather a place of discourse and is integral to government, as we have seen, and the laws that we abide by. And who controls the public sphere has been a hot debate even a week ago when they're talking about, Twitter or something. You know, who controls Twitter? It is essential to democracy, and the control of the public sphere is essential to democracy, and implicitly against fundamentalism, whether religious or secular, if by that term we mean groups who intend disruptive violence to others. The discourse of the public sphere influences legislation and governance, and is in turn influenced by them. It is the realm wherein debate can take place, not only about legislation and governance, but about the deeper values that inform them, about what it is to lead a good life and what justice is. While almost every conflict in the world has a religious component, it is also at the level of discourse in the public sphere where conflicts of value occur. Indeed, one of the most important debates concerns which values the public sphere should be guided by, the values of religions or the values of secularism. What is the place of religions in the public sphere and more broadly within the global community? In a popular book entitled The Cube and the Cathedral, George Weigel offered two alternative visions of Europe. The book raises the question as to why, in spite of the vital role of Christianity has played in the formation of Europe, it was not mentioned in the European Union Constitution. This is the inevitable development of what Locke had articulated, if not actually started, the complete expulsion of religion from discourse about the state. The Cube is a colossal cube-shaped piece of art entitled La Grande Arche de la Défense, if you excuse my pronunciation, erected by President Mitterrand in the business quarter of Paris. I don't know if anyone's been there. It's a massive thing. Which symbolises a secularised Europe, in which religion is completely expunged from the public sphere. The cube was intended by its Danish and French architects to engineer and architects and engineer to be a monument to humanity and humanitarian ideals. By contrast, the Cathedral of Notre Dame, built in the 12th century, is still a living monument to the power of Christianity. Which, asks Weigel, represents the best future for Europe, the purely secular vision devoid of any religious orientation, or a future in which religion, specifically Christianity in this context, is at the heart of moral renewal? The responses to this question are complex and made more complex by the demographic makeup of Europe, with large Muslim populations and other religions and ethnicities. And, you know, 10 years' time, there could be more Muslims in Europe than Christians, for example, perhaps for 20 years' time. While the situation may be different in the Americas and in Asia, the case of Europe serves to highlight some important issues about the place of religion in the public sphere and political and social life. While the public sphere of the West, if we might call it that, is clearly important in terms of world power and universality, conducted primarily through the medium of English, it is not the only public sphere. China is particularly important and will be in the future as the centre of civilization shifts once again from the West. And Islam has conducted discussion in a parallel public sphere. In a sense, there was a public sphere in South Asia conducted through the medium of Sanskrit. The Sanskrit cosmopolis spread from Kashmir to Cambodia in the medieval period, although the concerns of discourse were primarily epistemological and ontological, and social criticism at the level of discourse was largely absent. But at present, it is the public sphere as formed in relation to Western nation-states that has become a global integrated network of discourse, and that's for historical reasons of colonialism and so on. Religions are global systems and have proven to be very resilient to secularization and have adapted and transformed to modernity. In spite of the dominance of science in terms of the truth of empirical claims and the development of sophisticated technology, religions have been remarkably adaptable, especially to computer technology and the internet. Literalist or fundamentalist forms of religion have adopted modernity. The internet has been used to spread the message of Islamist groups, of Falun Gong, of Catholicism, and all significant religious groups. But while virtual communities are important, religions cannot function only in virtual terms. As we have seen, religions address fundamental human needs and entail bodily exploration and being in community, and religions bring their communities into presence with each other. And into the present, using technology in the service of their generally ancient purposes. Now, in theory, I suppose in theory, a purely technological religion is possible. There was Donna Haraway's book, I've got it here somewhere. Donna Haraway's book, Cyborgs, Simians, and Feminism, or something, in which she was positing the purely virtual religion. And there was William Gibson's novels. Anyone read William Gibson's novels? Neuromancer. You remember that? It shows your age as you refer to it. In which he posited a purely a virtual world, in which he lived in a purely virtual world and neglected the body. It was a very Gnostic kind of novel. In this kind of virtual reality. But in practice, this will probably never occur as long as we're bodily creatures that we are. The public discourse of religion is predicated upon the bodily life of religion. Religion in the public sphere is secondary to the practices of prayer, asceticism, worship, and the ritual reception of text, along with the modes of fellowship and social organisation that religions foster. Alongside traditional practices, religions have tended to become to welcome new technology and globalisation, especially traditions which have a missionary imperative, as new technology functions in the service of disseminating their truth. In spite of religious differences, religions which exist in close connection with each other, particularly in the Western democracies, participate in the global economy, global communication, and local political institutions. All are stakeholders in contemporary political life. and all have some vision of what the ideal society would be, or more specifically, what kind of political discourse would foster the development of the good life. It is over this question, what would constitute the good life and what would be the shape of a politics that promotes it, that difference and conflict occur between religions and between religions in the secular state. On the one hand, we have extreme fundamentalist positions that interpret scriptures very literally and tend to be highly conservative in their social mores, especially with respect to the rights of women, while on the other, we have a libertine, secular ideology that is fundamentally amoral and claims that the highest good is simply a successful life in the world, seen in terms of worldly prosperity and even the maximisation of pleasurable experience. There are more nihilistic versions of this latter position, and there is a spectrum of views between these extremes. Thus we have a variety of new religious movements and what have become known as quasi-religions and humanist and atheistic systems that cross the boundary between the religious and the secular, as Kim Knott has lucidly pointed out. So I suppose an example of that maximisation of pleasurable experience, or who's that German performance artist, who sacrifices animals on the stage and stuff? He talks about orgiastic release of energy to purify the nation. It's very German. Hermann Nitsch. He's worth inquiring into. You should see the website. Hermann Nitsch. Performance art. He wants this cathartic release of energy in the society for the purification of the tribe. Now, it's a kind of very bleak vision, I think. It's realistic. Yeah. Now, most religions that engage with modernity are critical of the secular state, particularly what are perceived to be its moral shortcomings, but want to engage with it and want to participate as citizens in the countries to which they belong. Most religious people today negotiate multiple identities as religious persons, as holders of jobs, as parents of children, as politicians, and as citizens. So moving on to the secular public sphere section of this, which is... Still on page two. Good heavens. The issue of the compatibility of the citizen with competing religious claims came out in France, where the policy of laïcité has brought the authorities into conflict with religious minorities. As Roger Trigg observes, the term laïcité is hard to translate, although it denotes the neutrality of the state towards all religions and specifically refers to three values: freedom of conscience, equality of religions in law, and political neutrality. In 2003, President Chirac remarked that the French Republic is composed of citizens and cannot be segmented into communities. Part of the policy has been the banning of all religious accoutrements from public places, such as schools, in 2004. And this ban has included the prohibition of the display of crucifixes, turbans, and most controversially, of the hijab, the Muslim head covering, which is a highly sensitive issue in the country with 5 million Muslims. And then more recently, the banning of the burqa, the complete covering of the face. Now, in the case of the hijab, this aggressive secularism claims that such legislation is being true to the emancipatory spirit of the Enlightenment, and is in fact liberating women, even if they claim they do not want to be liberated. While the aim of laïcité is integration, this is a model that goes against much of the spirit of liberalism in marking a boundary of toleration beyond which a society will not go, and having a view of citizenship which is highly conformist to state policy. On this view, to be a good citizen is to conform to the dictates of the secular state. There is a conflict between the citizen and the member of a religious community. Arguably, though, there are other models of secularism which are more tolerant and less centralised than the French version. Part of this can be understood as a defensive response to the threat and indeed attack from the extreme Islamicist groups, which is perceived more broadly as an attack by Islam on the West in the broader perception of people. To defend the West's way of life, so the argument goes, we need legislation which ensures and safeguards its citizens. But this is arguably an impoverished view of citizenship which extols sameness and a vapid conformity to state authority. Another model of secularism would be one which in which difference is celebrated, in which religions have a legitimate place in the role of education, for example. The problems here arise when there is a perception that a group of people are sharing in the benefits of the secular state, such as freedom of expression, while at the same time offering a rhetoric and pattern of action which undermines that state and openly declares hostility towards it. The philosopher who has most clearly developed a notion of a tolerant public sphere is Jürgen Habermas. For Habermas, the public sphere is a realm in which different traditions can converse. And his task has been, in Nick Adams' words, to, quote, identify rules for argumentation that transcend tradition. Habermas acknowledges that all discourse is situated within a particular location and accepts the view that to assess whether an argument is in accordance with reality, one would need to stand in a position outside of both the argument and reality, which is impossible. But what can we do? But what we can do is communicate effectively, and the task of the public sphere is a clarification of the communicative act. Speech communities come to consensus about events, but it is only possible to distinguish between genuine and false consensus on the grounds of the possibility of an unconstrained arena for dialogue that speakers have access to. This is the ideal speech situation, what he calls the ideal speech situation, which presupposes a mode of discourse that transcends the particularity of culturally bound communication. Through discourse, we can remove distortions to our self-understanding, which is the task of the social sciences. Human communication is universal, and different traditions can transcend their limitations and participate in this universal human quality. But this, in a sense, begs the question. There are particular languages and particular life worlds that we inhabit, but the ideal speech situation would seem to entail a language of moral action that exceeds the boundaries of particular tradition. It is clearly possible for us to think and speak beyond the limits of our culture, but the space in which this speech takes place is itself predicated upon a particular cultural life. This is not necessarily problematic, but there is a need to argue for the validity and universal applicability of that particular form of life. For many, this optimum ideal speech community comes close to liberal democracy. While the values of the cube seem to end up with a monolithic, intolerant state, in which any public despair of religious affiliation is suppressed, on the other hand, the values of the cathedral are from a bygone age. We no longer live within the sacred canopy of a Christian cosmos, and of necessity have had to adapt to a new situation. At worst, the sacred canopy of faith creates intolerant and crushing regimes, particularly for women, as we have seen in the various kinds of fundamentalism that have cut themselves off from liberal political and legal structures, such as Mormon polygamous sects in the States. Surely there is a way of living and acting between the cube and the cathedral. Surely as contemporary human beings we can display tolerance or, more strongly, affection or friendship towards others who live a very different form of life and culture to our own. Even when this is difficult, friendship towards others becomes a kind of asceticism, which, in the end, can be transforming of the social matrix. But first we need to ask the question as to whether there is a convincing reason why people from different cultures and different religions should share a public discourse other than the practical contingencies that not to do so leads to misunderstanding and conflict. There is clearly an element of self-interest in the dialogues of religions with each other and with the secular state. As John Milbank observed some time ago, tolerance is a value that has developed within a particular liberal milieu, and is only held by those who share that view. Mm-hmm. Thus, dialogue is only undertaken by those who already share the values of tolerance. Mm-hmm. A traditional Hindu Brahmin, for example, who is not schooled through a liberal English education, would not be particularly interested in dialogue or learning about the other. There is a history of in the Brahmanical case, there's a history of insularity. Not so much hostility to the other, but simply an indifference to modes of discourse other than those of the Brahmanical Sanskrit tradition. You read some of these texts, and there's a vast political changes occurring in the subcontinent, particularly with Muslims and so on. And there's no reference to Muslim. There's no discourse with the Muslims in the medieval period. It's interesting, or interest. So it's a kind of self-contained discourse. And what is wrong with that? John Milbank says he thinks we should get... tongue-in-cheek in that article a long time ago now, he said we should get rid of the values of tolerance and replace those values with mutual suspicion. No, I think that's a particular extreme view. Now, for Christianity and Islam, there is some internal impulsion towards intellectual engagement with other traditions, namely conversion. But clearly the idea of tolerance or plurality is a modern phenomenon, although we must not forget periods in history where the cross-fertilization of ideas has flourished, as in 13th century Spain, where Jewish, Muslim and Christian intellectuals engaged in discussion. The imperative to coexist and engage in conversation is even more necessary in the contemporary context. Of course, the traditional Brahmin intellectual has no particular interest in shared debate in the public sphere, but the shrinking world and the development of global economies and the global politics necessitates that intellectual traditions engage with each other. It is a demand of modernity that traditions so engage. While it is important that intellectual traditions exist within the boundaries of their own coherence, Islamic philosophers still debate in Qom in Iran, Hindu philosophers still debate in Varanasi, Jewish philosophers still debate in Jerusalem. There also needs to be intellectual engagement in the public sphere because it is desirable, according to most people, to avoid violent conflict and resolve issues of shared interest through dialogue rather than through aggression. It might well be possible to have Alastair MacIntyre's educational institutions based wholly on internal tradition concerns. Thus we might have Catholic universities, Hindu universities and so on that he developed in his Gifford lectures. But there is some compulsion with globalisation for these traditions to mutually engage with each other. For modern liberalism, the idea of tolerance that we should all get along seems to be a fairly uncontentious claim. However, liberal tolerance is not as politically and culturally neutral as it might at first appear. To bring the problems into sharper relief, let us look at the counterview which extols the virtues of tradition and makes a strong claim for the religious voice in the public sphere. Let us call this the traditionalist view. We can then look at a version of the secularist view concerning the neutrality of the public sphere, and finally outline the beginnings of a modified traditionalist view focused on the citizen. So I know I'm going to present these two views, the traditionalist view, drunk, and the secularist view, and then offer a notion of the religious citizen. If Habermas is a theorist of universal communication in the European context, one of the most influential political and moral philosophers to espouse the values of liberalism in recent years has been John Rawls, who dies in 2002. Whose theory of justice, published in 1971, attempted to establish a rationality for justice based on principles that we could all agree to give an original situation in which we all subscribe to a basic social structure. What do you call this original situation? If people were placed behind what he called a veil of ignorance, without prejudicial knowledge of their own and other situations, they would practice justice as fairness. It's a very optimistic view of human nature. Given such equality, it would be rational to choose a kind of society that has a framework of individual liberties as well as concern for the least well-off. This depended on a view of the self as neutral and unencumbered by the prejudice of tradition. In a way not dissimilar to Habermas's ideal situation, Rawls argues that social and political institutions that favour individual rights are conducive to human flourishing. In contrast to this position, communitarian criticism of the idea of the unencumbered self and liberal neutrality developed a view that we are beings located in history, tradition and communities, and our choices are inevitably informed by our situations and locations. These thinkers, particularly McIntyre and Sandel, who was over here recently actually, developed what became known as communitarianism, that the self is embedded within communities and the individual is shaped by the ambient society and culture. Although he does not directly engage with Rawls, Milbank can be understood in this context, as can Gavin da Costa and Stanley Hauerwas. Now, for McIntyre, liberal individualism that develops from the Enlightenment is unable to provide a moral basis for society because of its tendency to moral relativism and its lack of the idea of a shared human telos, other than individual desires and purposes. This critique of liberalism is echoed by Sandel, who claims that liberal ethics is wrong because the idea of neutrality is impossible, as we can never wholly escape the effects of our conditioning. It is simply an illusion that we can stand, as it were, outside of ourselves and outside of our histories. For McIntyre, justice and virtue are ideas with histories as specific to traditions of thinking, of particular importance being the classical and Christian tradition. In After Virtue, which was published about 86, I think, or 85, he articulates a deep scepticism about the state of moral discourse in modernity. We live in a morally impoverished and fragmented environment in which the language of morality has been forgotten. The Enlightenment project, which has sought to develop a neutral moral space and an objective perspective on human life independent of tradition and historical context, has failed, according to McIntyre. What is needed is a revisioning of the moral landscape and a return to the Aristotelian paradigm of teleology. In the face of modernity's failure to produce a flourishing human community, we need to base an account of practical reason on the idea that human beings have a goal, and that goal should be development towards a good, which in effect means the development of virtue. This is essentially a recollection of the ideal of virtue, which has been lost. The modern self is emotive in the sense that moral judgments are seen to be merely expressions of preference, and this is true not simply in moral philosophy but culturally as well. That's time. I think I'll just whiz through some of this. Down towards the end of this page two, McIntyre says, through developing virtue, arete, we can lead a good life. So a modified traditionist view that acknowledges a communitarian critique might be developed, that that recognises the necessity of pluralism, the acceptance of the notion of the public sphere. Now, fundamentalism, moving on to fundamentalism. So far I've avoided speaking about fundamentalism, partly because the term is somewhat pejorative of millions of people in what they call the majority world, and partly because it signifies a highly diverse and complex phenomenon, not necessarily linked to violence. Pentecostal and charismatic churches throughout the world form a significant section of world Christianity. And there were an estimated 523 million Pentecostals in 2001. That's a significant number of the world's population. So to dismiss them all as fundamentalists it's to underestimate the power of that section of the planet. And so fundamentalism has and will have an important role to play in national and global politics. Similarly, Islamist groups, while linked to an ideology of violent overthrow of the West, play an important, complex part of world politics. Indeed, the word complex is appropriate, as the modern fundamentalism is often a different kind of modernism in the guise of tradition. Ali Shariati was the intellectual father of the Islamic Revolution, who translated Fanon's Les Damnés de la Terre, the Damned of the Earth, using the Quranic term the disinherited, Mustazafan, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, which had a wide impact and illustrates the cross-fertilization of ideas. So in fact the Islamic revolution is not purely Islamic but comes via Fanon. Interesting. We cannot tar all these groups with the same brush, and there are instances in which local communities have been greatly aided by Islamist groups in times of national crisis, such as natural disasters. So in Africa, these so-called fundamentalist Islamic groups do an awful lot of social work, you know, with poor people, especially in times of famine and crisis and all the rest of it. Now, the moral judgment about fundamentalism depends very much upon where one stands, and there are many of these groups have strong local support. Fundamentalism is a response to modernity and reflects human insecurity at losing the certainties of the old cosmology and social structure. Clearly, the rise of science and the development of technology have threatened traditional religious worldviews, along with changing social attitudes. Some religious groups react to these rapid changes by simply reflecting them in favour of an inward-looking, rejecting them in favour of an inward-looking worldview and closing themselves from evidential refutation. So the Mormon Church and the offshoots of the Mormon Church would be examples of that. Now, lastly, then, religious citizen. The concept of citizenship is an invention of the West, coming from the idea of the Greek polis. And you could argue that there is a place within the idea of citizenship for the religious citizen as well. Citizenship entails liberal values. It's not a natural category. It's a category which has developed out of Western democracies. The citizen, I can't think of a Sanskrit word for citizen. Nayaka or something? It's a man of the world, really. Is there a citizen? Is there a Sanskrit word for citizen? I don't think so. Anyway, citizenship entails certain kinds of values, liberal values, and it's not a natural category. And the citizen has obligations to the state, such as paying taxes, obeying the law, has obligations to fellow citizens, and the obligation to abide by the law. There's a philosopher called Kleimika who wrote an interesting book called Multicultural Citizenship. Which I thought I wrote about. There you are. And he offers a solution to this problem. He says that he argues for the rights of minorities, but within a broad framework of liberal democracy. So there are, he says, a good group rights, what he calls good group rights, that should be legally protected, such as the rights of ethnic minorities to education and healthcare. And there are bad group rights, what he calls bad group rights, which should not be legally protected and discouraged, particularly the restriction of individuals in the community in the name of group solidarity. Thus, the argument by a particular religious or cultural minority that women's rights should be restricted because this is in accordance with their traditions should not be held up, because this conflicts with the values of liberalism on upholding the individual, he says. Liberal democracies should not support the demand by minority cultures to restrict the basic rights of its own members. But the problem here is, on what grounds does a liberal tradition claim the importance of individual rights over the rights of communities in certain ways? If, for example, an African ethnic community practices female circumcision, a highly controversial practice, on what moral grounds does the liberal society prohibit this? Of course, there are legal grounds, but the only appeal is to the liberal ideal of individual human rights and the appeal to the notion of equality, i.e. the values of liberalism. Which model dominates, the values of liberalism or the values of particular tradition, could in the end simply be a question about power. Liberalism has the power to impose its view on the ethnic minority. On this view, the discourse of liberalism, when it comes down to it, is a discourse about power and an extension into modernity of the colonialist enterprise. That would be a cynical view of it. But this argument for moral relativism does not stand up. While of course there is no neutral ground from which to assess moral claims, there is a strong argument that the rights of minority traditions and ethnicities in the liberal state can be ensured so long as they do not infringe upon the rights of the individual to lead a successful life. Success might mean the degree of human flourishing, a vague term which can be taken to mean something like enabling the maximum conditions in which a person can fulfil their goals. These goals are individual, but also communal, in that individuals' identity is closely bound up with the narratives of tradition. And justice cannot be separated from aims which are constrained by the values and stories of tradition, as McIntyre has observed. The story of my life, quote, is always embedded in the story of those communities from which I derive my identity, end quote. Now, so going to the end of my handout then, arguably being a citizen is not incompatible with allegiance to religious traditions. And this is to defend a liberal position deriving from Locke that relegates governance to the public realm and religion to the private realm in an attempt to avoid the violence of religious conflict. So arguably being a citizen is not incompatible with allegiance to religious traditions. In some countries, particularly the USA, is almost a precondition for what is regarded as being a good citizen. In some ways, this is to defend a liberal position deriving from Locke, yet a religious humanism remains at the level of discourse and cannot substitute for the power of religious action and speech. Such a position does advocate the legitimacy of religious traditions' responses to the world as mystery and unfathomable strangeness, to their claim to lay hold of the world of life and the rights of traditions to operate within different moral orientations, but necessarily within secular law. While in my view we must uphold the values of democratic cultures against theocracies, these values embrace pluralism and the multiple voices that of that express the religious imperative. The religious imperative and the kinds of subjectivity it expresses are legitimate ways in which human beings can respond to the mystery of life.